So the discussion today is the para aduma, the red cow, the red heifer. And the red heifer is looked at as one of the most mysterious mitzvahs in the entire Torah. We'll discuss why it's mysterious. Again, let's just give a brief synopsis of what it's all about, and then we'll discuss what it means. We discussed, I think, many times before, the concept of becoming tameh, becoming impure. And the most severe type of impurity is contact with the dead body. Any Jew who comes to contact with the dead body becomes tameh, impure, to the highest degree. And the only way to get out of that, to purify yourself, is through the ashes of the red heifer, of the red cow. The red cow has to be totally red. If there's two hairs on it that are not red, it's invalid. It's a very rare find. We've only prepared, historically, 9 red cows total in Jewish history. The first one was prepared by Moshe. There'll be a 10th one prepared by the Mashiach, is what the Rambam says, what the sages teach us. So we're waiting for that 10th red cow to be prepared for the times of Mashiach to purify us all. That's the idea of the red cow. A red cow has to be about 3-4 years old. It can't have any blemishes, similar to a sacrifice. Sacrifices have to be pure and healthy. Again, there's qualifications what makes a blemish, but can't be blemished. It has to be something which is a pure, healthy animal. The way it was prepared is that they would slaughter it similar to a sacrifice. It was not prepared in the temple. It was prepared outside the temple. It was prepared actually across the on Mount of Olives. Those have been in Israel, you know, behind the Temple Mount, the Mount of Olives, the cemetery there right now, an old Jewish cemetery. But that's where they prepared the red cow. So it was on the Mount of Olives. They would slaughter it similar to sacrifice. They would sprinkle the blood in the direction of the temple. I mean, usually the blood of sacrifice is sprinkled onto the altar. This was not done in the temple. This was done outside the temple. So they sprinkled the blood in the direction of the temple, directly opposite the Holy of Holies. And as a matter of fact, they actually built this structure so the Kohen could be peering into the temple as he was slaughtering the red cow. So it was very much similar to sacrifice, but yet it wasn't a sacrifice. It wasn't something you're offering up to God. It wasn't burnt on the altar, and it was not done in the temple grounds. But they slaughtered it. They would sprinkle the blood towards the direction of the temple. Then they would burn it totally, and they would throw into the fire some wood of a cedar tree, the azo plant, which I think it translates as a hyssop plant, and some red strings. Red strings, shmitolah, some red strings. Very interesting things. So they would burn this all together, they come out with ashes. So at the end you'd have a big pile of ashes, which was the burnt up cow, and then they did the hyssop, the cedar, and the red string. So they would then take these ashes, and they would have to get water from a flowing source, some sort of spring or a flowing stream. They would put that into a vessel, they would drop ashes into the water, and now that water is prepared to sprinkle onto those who are impure. So if somebody was impure, the Kohen would take another piece of azo hyssop, a hyssop branch, dip it in the water, and he would sprinkle it onto the person who was impure. Now, the way the process works, a very interesting process, there has to be a count of 7 days. In the, after the first 3 days, on day 3 they get sprinkled one time. Then on the day 7 they would get sprinkled a second time. And then after that they'd go to the mikvah. And after that process they'd be totally pure from the impurity. Now again, this only applies to tumah, to impurity that comes from a dead body. Any other impurity you can purify with, you know, simply with the mikvah. Only impurity from a dead body requires the ashes of the red cow. Very, very interesting halacha. Another point about the red cow is that it has to be a cow that was never actually used for work. You know, in the old days, the cows were essentially the tractors. You know, they put the plows on them and they would work the fields. If you ever used it for work, then you could not use it for the service of the red cow. I don't know if those have seen it. There have been reports of a red cow discovered in New Jersey recently. Anyone hear about that?
Yeah, Rabbi Herzfeld talked about
it. Oh, yeah?
But they
validated it, yeah?
No, I think
it turned out it wasn't totally red or something. I don't know. I mean, a few months back I saw a video about it, which is fascinating. I mean, again, these things come out. Every once in a while somebody thinks they found a red cow. And again, they're very, very rare because 2 white or black hairs invalidates the entire thing. And if the farmer didn't know and he used it for any sort of work, that also validates it. So a non-Jewish farmer somewhere in who knows where has a cow that's totally red but uses it one time for work, he invalidates the cow for the service.
The 9 cows that
Yeah.
Was it in Arab life? Like, was the 9th?
No, we're talking about in the times of the temple. It's a long time ago.
So 9 and 10 times.
Yeah, I mean, since the destruction, there hasn't been a red cow performed since then. So essentially nowadays, if you become impure through being near a dead body, you cannot become pure until we find this red cow once again. So the assumption is that every single Jew is probably impure based on the fact that all of us have been to funerals, been to cemeteries, etc. The only people maybe not is a Kohen, but even Kohanim are not as careful as they could be in my situation. So the assumption is that every single Jew is impure at this point. And the only way to rectify that would be by finding a red cow and performing the service. And again, in this 10th red cow that we're awaiting will be done by the Mashiach. And that's what the Tzidus teach us. Okay, fine. And there's many, many, many more details of this red cow service, which I think are beyond the scope of our discussion right now. But you see how specific it is and how strange it seems to be. I mean, every single detail, why a cow and why red and why burn it and what's with the water and what's with the hyssop and the cedar tree and the red strings and why is it slaughtered outside the temple and inside the temple. I mean, every single step of the way, things seem very strange and mysterious, hard to understand. So what that brings us to at this point is before we get into understanding the red cow a little bit more in and of itself, the red cow is looked at as a model for the entire Torah. I mean, it's a paradigm. It's a paradigm of the irrational, ununderstandable mitzvah. That's what it is. We've discussed before, when we began discussing mitzvahs way back, we gave an introduction about different types of mitzvahs. And the truth is, ultimately, every mitzvah is performed only because it's the will of God. And whether we understand it or not, we do it. But mitzvahs come in categories. Some mitzvahs are very understandable. We understand why not to steal, why not to murder. We can understand the idea of adultery. We can understand the ideas of loving your neighbor as ourselves. Many mitzvahs are very easy to understand. Some mitzvahs, we may not understand fully the details, but we understand the idea. So just Shabbos is a day of rest. We know that God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh. So we understand the idea of having a day of rest. We understand a holiday. You know, the fact that we want to mark the miracles of the Exodus, we can understand having Pesach. We understand having Sukkot. We understand the ideas of the holidays are marking historic events, reminding us of the miracles of God. So that's like another category of mitzvahs. So one category is called mishpatim. Mishpatim are those which we can understand 100% the idea of the mitzvah. And that's like something like don't steal, don't murder. There's something called edos. Edos are like symbolic testimonies. And that's like a category of Shabbos or Pesach. The idea of redeeming a firstborn child, to remember the death of the firstborn in Egypt. These mitzvahs, even though we don't understand exactly how, why, the details 100%, but we can understand this is symbolic of something which occurred. There's a third category of mitzvahs which are called chukim, a chuk. The idea of a chuk is something which is irrational, something that we really don't have an understanding of. Why can't we eat milk together? What's wrong with wearing shatnez, wool linen together? Why is it that the sacrifice is done in certain ways? What's the idea of taking a lulav and esrog? I mean, these things which the rational mind can't really figure out, like what's the concept, those are more in the realm of a chok, of chukim. The idea of a chok, so the famous commentator, Rabbeinu Bachaya, he writes that the word chok itself, so chok literally translates usually as like law or statute. But the word chok could have two other connotations to it. He says that a chok is used to mean a border or a limit. And he says that the idea of a chok is that it recognizes the limits of our minds. That there's certain things that our minds are not going to understand. That's the idea of a chok. It's similar. It says in the prophets that God made a chok for the ocean. I mean, there's a border of the ocean. It doesn't go past. There's the sand and there's the sea. And there's a kind of a limit to the ocean. There's a limit to our minds. That's the idea of a chok. The other idea, deeper concept, he says, is that the idea of chok also can mean something which is etched in or carved in, engraved. And he says that a chok is something which, even though in this world we don't understand, we're trying to tap into something which is kind of etched in or engraved in higher worlds. So even though in this world I don't understand why I perform a chok, I have to know that the chok in this world is merely symbolic of something which is etched in and engraved in a much higher plane. As a simple analogy, I would say that sometimes you can go to an art museum. And you see this like interesting work of art. And you have no clue what it's supposed to mean or symbolize, or why he drew it that way. You don't see the wisdom in it. You just see a bunch of paint splotched on a canvas. And you speak to the artist, he'll say, well, the blue in the corner represents a certain emotion which I had at the time. And the green splotch over there is supposed to represent the idea of the earth and the grass. And that little squiggle in the corner of yellow, well, that's supposed to represent a human being's happy times he has in life. But, I mean, he could come up with all these things. He knows exactly what it's all symbolizing. You, as the observer, say, I have no clue what this means, right? So a chok, and it's a very rough analogy, but a chok is very similar, that God knows exactly what every step of chok is supposed to mean, but it's something that our minds just can't figure out. It doesn't make sense to us. But ultimately, we know that a chok is representing something much higher in the heavens, and it's supposed to symbolize something much greater than our minds can understand. So all the strange, intricate details you have in different chukim, that all is supposed to tie into the idea that our minds do have limited understanding, and that there is something much higher we're trying to perform or tap into, despite the fact we don't understand. Now, really, there's many, many chokes in the Torah, and like I said, ultimately, we're supposed to view that every mitzvah as a chok to some degree, because we do it because God said so. We don't know all the reasons God said what He said, and even though we think we understand why not to steal or why not to murder, but there's reasons that we don't understand about it also. So the idea of really every single mitzvah should be viewed as a chok to some degree, but there are mitzvahs which are primarily chukim, and then the red cow is viewed as the quintessential, the paradigm of chok. The Torah says, Zos chukas haTorah. This is the chok of the Torah, is what the Torah says. So the Torah itself calls the mitzvah of the red cow the chok of the Torah. This is the one which is totally beyond us, the one which is most irrational, ununderstandable. That's the idea of a chok. And the sages tell us that even King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, who was known as the wisest of all men to ever walk the face of the earth, he couldn't understand this one either.
King Solomon?
King Solomon, yeah. King Solomon called the Chacham, he called the wisest of all men. And Solomon couldn't understand it. The rabbis say that Moshe understood it. Moshe understood it through prophecy. So prophecy is that God actually, He imbues you with the understanding. But King Solomon, who was trying to use his own mind to understand it, not through prophecy, he understood everything else. He couldn't understand this one. This one still mystified Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. So we have many, many chukim out there, many chokes. And this one is so complex. I mean, there's a lot of intricate details here. But there are two main issues that are pointed out that make it so mysterious. Is that number one, it's a service that appears like a sacrifice, but is done outside the temple. Now, in general, a sacrifice outside the temple is considered a very serious crime, according to Torah law. It's something which is considered a major breach in Torah law. Once the temple was built, no one's ever allowed to make a sacrifice outside the temple. And this essentially is not a sacrifice. But yet, you're going through all the motions of a sacrifice outside the temple, which leads people to think that maybe this is some sort of idolatrous practice. You watch the Kohen, he's standing, not in the temple, he's on a mountain, the next mountain over. And he's slaughtering an animal, and he's burning an animal, and he's sprinkling blood as if he's offering a sacrifice there. So people are likely to think he's doing idolatry. So that's one thing which is very strange about this. And then the strangest part of it all is that there's a fascinating detail, or halacha, which comes along with the red cow, which is that despite the fact that the red cow is made to purify those who are impure, every person along the way who involves himself in the service becomes impure, which is very, very strange. So the whole goal of this service, that we're producing these ashes to purify somebody who's been in contact with the dead person and became impure. But if I'm the one who carried the ashes around, and I burnt the ashes, and anything I do with those ashes impurifies me. So you have something here which is a paradox. It purifies those who are impure, but those who are pure, it impurifies. So it's a very strange thing. It's something which, you know, intellectually we have trouble dealing with. We understand that, you know, if you have soap, soap cleans. If you have dirt, dirt makes you dirty. How is it that dirt will make you clean and soap makes you dirty? That's something which is hard to understand. So that's something that the Parah Aduma, the red cow, is something which is so counterintuitive, because it purifies those who are impure, but it impurifies those that are pure. Very strange thing. They're allowed to be impure as long as it's not because of a dead body. If a Kohen becomes impure for other reasons, it's okay. Their prohibition is not to come touch with the dead. So that's why they can't go into a cemetery or etc. But other impurities are okay for a Kohen. Now, they can't enter the temple if they're impure. But that's a different problem. But they're allowed to be impure. They just can't do the service at that point. When it comes to contact with the dead, they can't. They're not allowed to be in contact with the dead. So the idea of the Parah Aduma, the red cow, is actually an opportunity to discuss this concept overall of the irrational in Torah, the irrational in Judaism. Now, there's a lot of things in Torah which we do have difficulties with understanding. You know, a lot of things that We read and we say, I don't understand that. And hopefully we're obedient and we do it anyways. But the question is, how do you approach the idea that so much of the Torah does seem to be hard to understand or irrational at times? Again, and this is the paradigm of it all. Paraduma, even the sages themselves point out, this is the most irrational part of the Torah, and either way we have to accept it, but this is the chok, this is it. So I want to share with you something which was written in the commentary of the Torah called the Akedas Yitzchak. It was written by someone named Rav Yitzchak Arama, who was, if I remember correctly, he was a great Spanish sage living around the time of the expulsion from Spain. And Rav Yitzchak Arama, he actually discusses this concept of, you know, how does one intellectually approach the Torah? I mean, is it supposed to make sense? Are we supposed to accept it with blind faith? Like, what is the approach to the Torah? When you sit down to study the Torah, the mitzvah, how should you approach it intellectually? How deeply should you analyze? If you reach something that you don't understand, how do you react to that? So he points out there's actually three groups, or three different categories of people of how they approach the Torah. Three approaches. The first group we'll call, I guess, blind acceptance. You say, I take it at face value. Whatever it says, I believe is true. I don't look any deeper than the surface. And I do as I'm told. Now, that's the idea of taking it at face value. Now, this is something which is, you know, the person has a lot of faith. And then when they start that way, because you're saying, I'm accepting it all on faith, and I'm just looking at it blindly. However, this is something which also is looked at negatively in Judaism for a number of reasons. You'll misunderstand concepts. If you take the Torah at face value, literally. So the Torah says, for instance, that, you know, God smelled the aroma of a sacrifice. Now, we don't believe that God actually smells physically. We don't believe anything, there's anything physical about God. But you can read the Torah, you see a lot of physical metaphors about God. If you take it at face value, then you're going to be misled. It's going to be heresy. You're going to say, well, God has a nose, and he sniffs, and he smells sacrifice. You're going to say that God has eyes, and he sees the world from his eyes. You're going to say that when it says that God got Vayichar Af Hashem, which we say is a metaphor for God's anger, you're going to say it means that his nose flared up. Right? That's what the word means. His nose flared. And that's wrong. That's something which goes against the tenets of Judaism. So you're taking the Torah totally at face value. The first problem is that you're going to misunderstand concepts, because you're going to take it all superficially. There's a second problem, which I would add in, that you miss the depth of it all. You know, it's a very childish way of understanding. The people who are taught the Torah as kids, you go to grade school or to Hebrew school, wherever, so you hear stories, and they're all given to you just at face value, very superficial. And, you know, for kids, it's okay to have a superficial story, but if an adult understands the Torah on a childish level, they're missing out on the depth of the Torah. The Torah carries out so much more wisdom and so much more guidance it can give us. But if you're stuck with the superficial understanding of a child, then you don't get anything from it. You're missing the point. You're missing the depth of it. You're dealing with God's wisdom, and you're looking at it like children's stories. So that's something, if you take it all just at face value, simply on blind faith, and you're not thinking into it, so you're going to miss the depth of it all. Additionally, somebody only has a very superficial understanding of the Torah, so they have no intellectual way of sharing the Torah with anyone else. You know, people ask you, you go to work, you walk in the street, ask you questions about Judaism, and you'll say, and this is what it says, you have no idea how to explain it, you have no understanding, you have no depth, no language which you can share with others and teach people about it, because you've taken a blind faith. So this is something which Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, in his commentary, he says, fits in with the verse you have in Proverbs, Pesi Yam L'Chol Davar, the fool believes everything. You can't approach the Torah in a foolish way and just take it all at face value. That's number one. So that's one group. So one group that says, I take it all at face value. Whatever it says, that's what it says. I don't think through it. I don't analyze it. I don't look any deeper. And I do it all with blind acceptance. That's one group. So that group, this commentary, and what we'll say is that that's an inappropriate approach to the Torah, because then you're not seeing something of depth, which you should see. There's a second group, which does use their intellect, and they analyze the Torah, and they try to understand the Torah to its depth, and when things don't make sense at the surface, they start plowing deeper in to figure out what it means. And this is an ideal approach to the Torah. But the question is, once you're using your mind, you're analyzing the Torah, let's say you hit a roadblock, and you're thinking through a verse, or a mitzvah, or a concept, and you get to a point, and you say, I don't understand what this means. It makes no sense to me. And you've done your best, and you still say, it's irrational. I don't get it. So at that point, you have two possibilities. What wins? Does the Torah win, or does your intellect win? Right? That's your options right now. So this commentary I'm sharing with you, Rizik Arama, he writes that, you know, the philosophers, they would say, well, the human mind dictates all. The real arbiter of truth in this world is the human mind. If we can't understand what the Torah says, it must be that I'm right and the Torah is wrong. That's the philosopher's approach. The approach of the true Torah approach, the approach of God-fearing Jews, is that, you know, I try to understand Torah to the best of my ability. If I reach a point that I can't understand, then I trust this is God's word, and it's, you know, and I'm limited. You look at your own personal limitations rather than the limitations of the Torah. You say the Torah is perfect. Torah Shem Tzimimo, we say in Psalms, the Torah of Hashem is perfect. It's complete and perfect. I am a human being, and therefore I'm imperfect. And if my mind can't understand it, it's not the Torah's fault, it's my fault. And it's my shortcoming. You know, there's no shortcomings in the Torah. And this is the concept we say, Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem, the beginning of all wisdom is the fear of God. And when it comes to learning Torah, step one is I fear God, and this is God's book. And God is all-powerful and almighty, all-knowing, and His book is 100% true and perfect. I do my best to be able to pull out all the wisdom I can from it, and if I hit a point that I don't understand it, I say, okay, you know, God's telling me checkmate, basically. You know, that I can't go any further, and God's right, and I'm just stuck at this point. So those are the two other groups. So the first group that takes everything at face value does not use their mind to understand anything. They say, okay, it says this, this is what we do. The second group are those who, let's say, are more philosophical, and they say, we'll use our minds to understand what it says. If we reach a point that we feel is irrational, then at that point we say the Torah is wrong and I'm right. And the third group says, no, I use the same exact approach as the philosophers. I analyze it to the best of my abilities. But once I hit a roadblock, the answer is not I'm right, the Torah is wrong. The answer is the Torah is always right, and I am a human being with a limited understanding and a limited mind, and therefore, I have work to do. And that's the answer to that. So those are our three different approaches. Now, so those last two groups we discussed, the group that says that everything lies in the human mind, there's a big problem with that group. Because you know, they're saying the human mind is what determines what's true and what's not true. If the Torah makes sense to me, it's true. If it doesn't make sense to me, it's not true. Well, where do you get your sense of truth? How do you know it's true and not true? What made your mind the decider of truth? Where we draw our values from? What gives the human mind the ability to determine what's right and wrong? What makes sense? I mean, think about it. You go through history, and you see it very much in modern times. What's right and what's wrong has changed drastically. We've all seen it in our lifetimes, and look at historically, things have changed, you know, decade to decade, century to century, even year to year. Even you look at the past 15 years in America, what's right and wrong is constantly changing. And what we used to think what was totally wrong is now considered right. It's now considered appropriate. And so how can my mind be that which determines right and wrong versus the Torah when we know the society is dictating how my mind feels? I mean, that's how we work. You know, so those things which really, usually those things which feel in the Torah don't make sense to us because we've been influenced by the culture around us. That's usually what happens. And ultimately our minds are biased too. Our minds are very biased from the fact that if we have to take and understand a concept of the Torah, it's going to bind us in some way to actually act upon it. There's a famous discussion by Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was a great Rosh Yeshiva in Europe, who was killed in the Holocaust. But he actually writes a fascinating thing. He discusses the idea, why is it, you know, we say it's so obvious to us that Torah is true and God is true, and we expect that a 12-year-old girl and a 13-year-old boy, when they're bar bas mitzvah, automatically accept the Torah 100%, and they do every single mitzvah, and if they don't do it right, then they're in the wrong, and if they're in the times where the Beis Din would punish them, they punish a 12-year-old girl or a 13-year-old boy for not doing a mitzvah. So we expect that it's that obvious, that simple, even to a little kid. He says, what about all the greatest philosophers and thinkers of human history that have denied the Torah? Like, if the Torah is so obviously true to us, why is it that great minds like, let's say, Aristotle, he uses as an example, didn't accept the Torah? How could that be? And Rav Elchanan, he writes that the answer usually lies in the fact that if you're going to accept the Torah, then you're bound to do what it says. And nobody wants to do what it says because that means it's going to infringe upon your lifestyle. So even though we would say it's an obvious truth, human mind is so biased we can look truth in the face, and we can deny it because we don't want to have to do what it says. That's how we live our lives. We all do that sometimes. You know, we all see things in front of us we know we're 100% right and true, but we ignore it because we don't want to deal with it. We do it all the time. So why is it the great thinkers of history didn't want to accept God or accept the Torah? Rav Yochanan writes, because if they did, again, this may have been a subconscious process. They weren't thinking this necessarily, you know, directly. But subconsciously, they understood, if I accept God, I have to act with certain values and morals. And I don't want to deal with that. So therefore, I can deny God, even though it might be an obvious truth. So our minds are biased. Our minds are very much affected and impacted by society around. And if we say our minds are going to determine what's true in this world, so then that's not something which is objective. That's subject, not objective. It's not objective, it's subjective truth. That's what it is. So this group that thinks we can study the Torah and we don't understand it, obviously the Torah is wrong. It's a flawed thought process. That's irrational. Because who gave you the right to determine right and wrong? Where did that come from? Why is your mind that which decides truth? And ultimately, we have to know that we've mentioned this before very, very often in this class, that our minds are creations of God and therefore they're limited. We know there are certain things our minds can't handle. We know that not just in Torah, but you know, in science and in life. And we know that nobody can possibly fathom the infinite, and nobody can fathom what existed prior to the world, and nobody can fathom, you know, there's certain things we just can't figure out. I always use the example, I've said it before in this class too, that if you take a calculator and divide by zero, it responds with error. And there's sometimes where our minds just say error. It's not right or wrong, because we can't do it. It's just impossible. So we have many things in life which our brains just can't pick up on. So you reach a part of the Torah, and your mind tells you error, doesn't make sense. So do you say, oh, it must be it's not true? No, the answer is, well, it's from God, and God understands far more than we do. But our mind just can't handle this. The human mind wasn't made for that thought process. That's what it means. The same way you can't divide by zero on a calculator that produces error, it's the same thing in our minds. Sometimes our minds just say, we can't go further than this. We're stuck. Even if you were Einstein, the smartest mind in the world, it wouldn't make a difference. You know, your mind just can't do certain things. So that's not the right tool for it. So we mentioned before, so Shlomo, King Solomon said, and the quote is, Amarti Echkama. The quote of Solomon is, I said I will become wise, v'hi rechok mimeni, but it's very distant from me. And the sages say he's referring to the red cow. That I said I will explore the red cow and understand, I'll become wise, and then he concluded, it's too far from me, I can't do it. That's what he said. It's not about the red cow. But that's the process of Torah study, is that the first thing you say is, Echkama, I'm going to become wise. I'm going to use my mind, and I'm going to explore and analyze and think and try to figure out the depths of God's Word. That's number one. And you try to suck out every single ounce of meaning and every single lesson and every single thing you can from the Torah. And every single word of depth and wisdom that comes out of there is something meaningful. But when you reach a point which we would call a chok, you reach something which says that this is a limit, that your mind can't understand this. At that point you say, like Shlomo did, it's distant from me. That's something which is too far beyond me to handle. So the wisdom of God is infinite and we can't understand it all. But there's a lot we can understand. So we have to put in the efforts and try our best to understand what we can. We analyze and we try to suck out every single drop of wisdom. But when you get to that point where your mind says, okay, I can't go any further, at that point you say that, okay, this is God's territory, and it's good and it's right, and I just can't understand that myself. So that's the approach in general, I think, to Aleva Chok. And then the Paraduma, the red cow, is the paradigm of this. It's not important for us because, you know, what is our approach to Torah study? You know, there are religions out there that say you take everything at face value, you don't question, and you don't analyze, and, you know, that's not a Jewish approach. The Jewish approach is, yes, you do analyze, you do question, and what they do in yeshivas all day long is question and question and question and question, and that's what they do. And they quote contradictions, and they give rational reasons why things don't make sense. But the goal is not them trying to do this to reject the Torah, rather that's what allows me to understand the depth of the Torah. The more you question something, the deeper in that you're going to go to understand it. And then once you get to a point that you say, I don't understand, so very often in the Talmud will have questions, and usually there's an answer to the question, but sometimes the Gemara will conclude the discussion with the word kasha. It's difficult. You know, that's it. That doesn't mean we don't do it. The halacha is still true, and we still perform the halacha, and it's still right, but some things we just can't understand. So it says kasha. It's difficult for us. We don't know what to do. That's it. You know? We don't say, let's tear it up because it's wrong, it's false. We say, it's just, you know, our minds just can't handle this. That's what it means. Our minds don't have, we have no way of answering the question. God has the answers. We don't have the answers. So that's this approach. Now, ultimately, we have to know that certainly everything has a reason, and even the red cow has reasons, and God has reasons. God, there's nothing that God puts in the Torah which is meaningless. There's nothing there which is just frivolous and worthless. Everything has a reason. It's just we can't understand all the reasons. But we're supposed to infer from the fact that much of the Torah we do understand, and we understand is good and makes sense to us. From that, we can infer that even the parts we don't understand also are good and make sense. That's our job. We're supposed to use all the parts of the Torah that make sense, and then draw from there that even the parts that don't make sense are also good and positive and needed for human life. And that's our job. Even the red cow, you do find certain ideas and symbolism and lessons within what the red cow stands for. But it's just that the mitzvah as a whole, we can't quite grasp. You know, you can look at details and pull out a lesson. You can't quite grasp the entire mitzvah. And ultimately, the bottom line always is, every mitzvah we do, not because we understand it, but because God said so. And that's what the Talmud says, and that's obvious, that we do the commands of God because God commanded them. Similar, you know, if you're in the army and the officer gives an order, you don't question. If you question, then you're going to be severely punished, court-martialed, etc. You do as you're told. After the war, if you want to start thinking through what was that strategy he was using, you can think about it. But at the time of the battle, you don't question your officer. You go ahead and you do what you're told. With all that said, I do want to point out just a few lessons you do find in the red cow, Parah Aduma. I mean, even though Parah Aduma is considered a chulk, it's something which is irrational and hard to, and difficult, and almost called impossible to understand. But again, certain details are given which give us you know, some sort of understanding or lesson or concept that we could learn from it. So just to quote a few. And again, nothing is going to encompass the entire mitzvah, being that it is the chok of the Torah. But there are interesting lessons which you find here. So number one, there's an interesting point made by the Abarbanel, a classic Spanish commentator. And the Abarbanel writes, well, the idea of the Parah Aduma, the red cow, is that you're trying to purify those who are impure. And the service is done, as we mentioned, outside the temple. So in a certain sense, it symbolizes the idea of somebody going, you know, outside the camp to bring in those who are not yet affiliated, not yet close. Meaning you could say it's an original symbol of Kiruv, of Jewish outreach. Because you're leaving the sacred, you're leaving the temple, you're going outside the temple, you're taking people who are impure, who are not necessarily connected to that which is sacred, and you're trying to bring them into the sacred. That's kind of the model of the service. Again, it's symbolic. I mean, the impurity we're dealing here is not necessarily sin. The impurity here is contact with the dead body. But the symbolism of it's really a symbol of Jewish outreach, of Kiruv. And the idea is that there are times where one has to leave their temple, leave their sacred quarters, leave their bubble, go outside the camp, find those Jews that are impure and need to be brought back into the sacred, and bring them back in. And that's the idea. But the other part of it, though, is that we mentioned that the service is done staring into the Holy of Holies. You're standing on the Mount of Olives, but you're staring back at the temple. I think somebody who is out teaching Jews who are unaffiliated, they can't lose sight of their goals. Once you leave the camp, so you have the risk, you're going to be influenced by those who are outside the camp, as it were. But if you keep your eyes on the temple at all times, and even when you're outside the camp, dealing with those who are impure, you can make sure that you keep your goals in mind. Your eyes are always on the temple, no matter what. And that's part of the symbolism of this. I mean, you find that for people who do get themselves involved in Jewish outreach, so many times you'll find somebody who leaves the established Jewish community and goes out to a much smaller town where there's very little Jewish infrastructure. I mean, I guess the primary example is Chabad, right? And you'll find Chabad families in the strangest of places in terms of the Jewish map. With very few Jews around, certainly no minyan, no kosher food, you know, no mikvah, no resources. And their job is to find Jews who are out there and purify them. That's their job. Now, the risk, you always run the risk that once you've cut yourself off from the Jewish community, how are you going to maintain your own personal connection? How are you going to do that? I mean, they don't have schools for their kids, and they don't have other Jews around to help them out, and they don't have kosher stores to go to. Like, how do they maintain their own Jewish life? So we're talking about Chabad as an example. I mean, Chabad has an amazingly a complex and tremendous network of all different Chabad rabbis throughout the world who are always talking, getting together. They have packets, they have resources, they even have online classes for kids who are living in far-flung areas. And they always have their eyes on the temple, as it were. They always have their eyes back into the sanctuary, even when they're out in the Chabad India, or the Chabad in Argentina, or the Chabad, wherever it is, Nebraska, wherever the Chabad might be, but they always have their eyes staring straight at the sacred. So those Chabad families, even though they may be outside the camp, as it were, they're always looking back into the camp and making sure they keep their connection, even though they're reaching out to other Jews who are outside the camp. So Chabad's a good example, I think. But that's the idea overall. Jewish outreach requires that you leave the comfort of your own Jewish area. You reach out to those Jews who aren't affiliated, but you have to make sure that you keep your focus. And you have to understand that where your roots should be. And that's the idea, one concept you find in terms of the red cow. Another concept of the red cow is that the sages teach us it's supposed to serve as some form of atonement for the sin of the golden calf. And the simple connection quoted is that, a calf is a baby cow. So it's like the mother is coming to clean up the mess her kid made. That's the analogy that the rabbis give. The kid made the mess, and the mother comes to clean it up. We know what that's like. But you do find a lot of connections between the service of the red cow and what happened to the golden calf. Rabbeinu Bechaya, he points out many connections. The Torah begins, and it says that V'yichu Elecha, they should take for you a red cow. God tells Moshe that all the people should participate, and everybody should help to bring in the red cow. Which is because when it came to the golden calf, it says that everybody went out and they got gold for the golden calf. So everyone participated in getting gold for the sin. So when it comes to preparing the red cow, everyone should participate in the red cow as well. We mentioned the idea of a cow. The mother cleans up the child, so the cow cleans up for the calf. It's red because sin is symbolized by red. That's the color that symbolizes sin throughout the entire Torah. It says that the red cow was supposed to be tamima, supposed to be perfect, without any blemishes, and that's supposed to counteract the idea that the Jews were perfect and became blemished through sin. It says that the cow never had a yoke upon it, never did any work, never had a yoke upon it, and that's supposed to counteract the idea that when we served the golden calf, we threw off God's yoke. We always talk about the yoke of heaven upon us. That's the terminology always used throughout the Torah, and when we served the golden calf, we threw off God's yoke, so when we have the red cow, it can't have a yoke upon it. It was given. The Torah says that Elazar the Kohen, who is Aaron's son, he should prepare the red cow. And part of the idea is that Aaron participated in the service of the golden calf. He was the one who they brought all the gold to. So therefore, he wasn't the right one to participate in the red cow service, because then he was the guilty party, as it were. You have to have somebody who wasn't guilty of serving the golden calf for participate in the red cow service. So you have that as well. There's a lot of the symbolism given. But you have this concept that the two parallel each other. You have the golden calf and the red cow, and the red cow service somehow parallels the golden calf. Now, what's the idea? Well, if you think about the purpose of the red cow, of purifying those who are impure, how does that at all relate to the golden calf? So one idea simply is that impurity and sin very much are connected. And if you're trying to purify impurities, that's also symbolic of purifying people who have sinned. But on a much deeper level, the sages teach us that when the Jews received the Torah at Mount Sinai, prior to the sin of the golden calf, so that was supposed to bring them back to a very high spiritual level, similar to that which existed in the Garden of Eden prior to the sin. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, before they sinned, were supposed to live forever. And the sages tell us, when we received the Torah, at that point, we would have lived forever had we not sinned. So, standing at Mount Sinai, before they served the golden calf, the Jews would have lived eternally. Because of our sin of the golden calf, just like when Adam and Chava ate from the tree, death came into the world, so too, when we served the golden calf, death came into the world as well. Death reintroduced to the world. So, the idea of the red cow is to purify those who become impure through dead bodies. So the reason that people have died is only because of the sin of the golden calf. So if you're purifying those who became impure through dead bodies, that is counteracting the results of the sin of the golden calf. So on a much deeper level, you see that this idea of death very much stems from the golden calf, and therefore the red cow purifies that. Very fascinating thing. There's two or three more quick points we'll just finish up with, just other lessons of the red cow. Rav Moshe Sternbach, who is one of the, I don't know if he still is, but he certainly was, he was the chief judge of the Beis Din of Eid HaChorias in Jerusalem. One of the top judges in Jerusalem in terms of the religious courts of Eid HaChorias. So he has a book on, he wrote a commentary on the Torah called Tam Vidas, and he writes in there a lot of symbolism, also the red cow. So one thing he writes, which is very fascinating, he writes that the idea of when something purifies the impure, and impurifies the impure, when we said there's kind of opposite results, it's symbolic to us of the idea that there's many things in Jewish life which are good for some and not for others. Not everyone has the same path to approach God. And for some people, what we would tell them, this is what you should do to become a better Jew, for somebody else would be the wrong thing to do. I mean, I'll take something very simple from my daily activities. So you take a boy studying in the yeshiva, and he wants to take off from learning to go and perform acts of chesed. So I would tell him, well, your job right now is you should be studying. That's why you're in yeshiva. Chesed is something very important to do. You should do it in your spare time. And when you're done in yeshiva, that's a great time to do chesed. Right now, it's usually an excuse to avoid learning yeshiva. Now, somebody's not in yeshiva, and they're given the chance to do chesed. So you'd say, great, go ahead and do the chesed. It's a wonderful thing to go help people. But you have to know, for this person at their stage in life, what's the right path to take? So the idea of the golden of the red cow is that some things will purify the impure, but they'll impurify the pure. So that's one idea you can bring out from this, that there's different paths in Jewish life, and not every path is good for everybody. Everyone has to find the path that fits them. That's one point he makes. There's another interesting point which he makes, Rav Sternbach, and he writes that the way the golden calf works, not the golden calf, the red cow works, right? Excuse me too now. The way the red cow works is that you slaughter it, you burn it, and you put it into the water, and you sprinkle the water. So he says that, what's this idea that you first burn it in ashes and then add it to water? What's that concept? So he says that the idea of slaughtering this cow, we said it's not really a sacrificial service, but it's very similar to a sacrifice. And it has the sanctity of a sacrifice in many ways. So you've done this tremendously sacred and spiritual service. You slaughter the red cow, you sprinkle the blood, similar to sacrifice, you burn it, similar to the sacrifice, and now what's left of it, just remnants, just ashes. That's what's left. And these ashes as they are won't do a thing. If you take those ashes by themselves and you toss them on somebody, it does not purify anybody. We said the opposite, it'll impurify people. You know, that's the ashes. Once you add the ashes to water, and then you sprinkle the water on somebody, they become pure. So it's in some way, the water has reawakened or activated the holiness of these ashes. That's what he writes. So again, you have this holy service where you slaughter the cow and you burn it, you sprinkle the blood as if it was a sacrifice. You then have meaningless ashes. You add it to water, the water activates the ashes, and those ashes have the ability to purify others. He says it's symbolic of something that every single Jew connects with, which is that all of us have greatness within ourselves. Often the greatness is not coming out to the surface, it's just kind of remnants of greatness. It could be based on the fact that we are Jews, we're children of the patriarchs and matriarchs. All of us have great ancestors that lived throughout history. All of us had experiences in life which put greatness within ourselves, but we don't always bring out the greatness. It's not always simple to bring out. It's like ashes, it's a remnant of something great. The ashes, it's a remnant of a great service, of a holy sacrificial service, but now it's merely ashes. When you put water into those ashes, they become great once again. They've been activated. It brings out the holiness. So what's the metaphor of the water? He says it's the Torah. The Torah is something that's called Mayim Chaim. It's called living waters. And when you take the Torah and you put Torah on a Jew, it brings out the best from within them. So we all have greatness within, but it's remnants of greatness. It's ashes. And those ashes came through us genetically, they came through life experience, they came through a lot of different ways. But until you take the Torah and pour it on the Jew, those ashes still remain dormant. They're not doing anything. Once you put the water on, like put the Torah on, suddenly activate and engage a Jew, and you bring out the greatness from within. So that's one symbolism you also find in the red cow. And one other interesting point, we'll close with this, is that the idea of the contradiction which exists, that you have something here which is purifies the impure, and impurifies the pure. So he said that it's really a model of Jewish history. In what way? So Rashi actually says about the red cow. Rashi says that the red cow is a mitzvah that other nations will come and question us about because it's so irrational. And they'll say, we don't understand. How can you have a mitzvah like this? And God says, you have to know it's a heavenly decree. You're not going to understand it. And finished. That's what God tells us. Even though everyone's going to question it and say it doesn't make any sense, it's irrational, we don't understand, God tells us, okay, that's what it is. You're not going to understand my ways. So the same contradiction exists in Jewish life overall. Non-Jews come to us and say, I don't understand. You say you're the chosen people. You say that you're God's special people who received this Torah, and you have all the greatness, you're a light to the nations. Look at you. Your nation is tiny. You've spent thousands of years of persecution, and there have been crusades and a Holocaust and pogroms and expulsions. And it doesn't make any sense. How could you be God's great people if you're so downtrodden and persecuted? And that's a question that we all have had around ourselves, and we've heard, and we understand. But it's something which is contradictory. It's that how can you be such a holy, holy nation? How could you be such a special service and purify those who are impure if you're impure yourself? How can you be God's holy nation if you're so downtrodden yourself? And the Paradum teaches us, this is the answer. The answer is that we don't understand God's ways all the time. And just like we tell the nations of the world, yes, this is irrational, we don't understand it, that's okay because God said so. That's what we talk about, that's how we discuss our history as well. A lot of history we don't understand. And we say the ways of God are hidden from us, as it says throughout all the prophets. And we say, but that's what it is. God said so. And then that's how things work. He makes one more point. We mentioned before that the mitzvah was told to be done not through Aaron, but through his son Eleazar. So we mentioned before one reason why that is, because Aaron was involved in the golden calf and Eleazar wasn't. But Rav Sternbuch says a different reason. He says that Aaron is somebody who understood this message already. This idea that God's ways we don't understand, Aaron experienced it. Because he had two sons that were killed during the dedication of the Mishkan. And the Torah tells us that Vayidom Aaron was silent. He didn't question God. He was silent. He already got the message. He said he didn't complain. He didn't question. He didn't reject God. He didn't rebel. He said, okay, I don't understand God's ways. And that's what it is. So Aaron understood the message very clearly that we don't always understand God's ways. So Eleazar, his son, who didn't go through that experience the same way as Aaron, he's the one given to do this mitzvah. And that's what Sternbuch writes. But it's a model for us overall that we have to know that God's ways ultimately are not understandable for us. As it says in the prophets, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. And we do our best to understand, but ultimately we're supposed to say that it's a chok, we don't understand it, but we know it's good. I mean, this is God's will, and we know it's the right thing to do. So that's the mystery of the paradigm of the red cow. That's the concept. Any questions?